Our second case this morning is 2020-1134, Acuity versus Masters Pharmaceutical Incorporated. For the appellant, Mr. Sesse.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, Ben Sesse for appellant Acuity. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Counsel, will you pull the microphone up a bit so we can hear you? Thank you.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time. Commercial general liability coverages are general in that they cover many risks not addressed by specialized policies, but they are not catch-all insurance. This appeal addresses the First District's gross expansion of a duty to defend in a CGL policy for governmental costs untethered to any person's bodily injury claim. The coverages at issue apply to sums the insured, quote, becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of bodily injury, close quote. The legal obligation is the tort duty, and bodily injury is defined as injury, quote, sustained by a person, close quote. To trigger a duty to defend, then, the complaint must allege a tort duty that requires the insured, here Masters, to pay plaintiffs, here the governments, damages on account of an injury to a particular person. So long as Masters' liability to a specific person is at issue, covered damages include all damages available in tort law, whether incurred directly by the injured person or by another person or organization. Here, however, the government's expressly—
So what if the government's claim had just been for Medicaid payments that the government had been forced to make? Because of opioid addiction.
If the government had been forced to make Medicaid payments because Masters tortiously harmed a particular person, then that obligation would be covered.
Well, what if the government said because of Masters oversupplying opioids in the state or the jurisdiction, our Medicaid expenses have increased by $20 million.
Then that wouldn't be covered, Your Honor. The link that is missing is a tort duty running to a particular person that Masters breached. That's why the coverage is written in the way it's written. It's why bodily injury is defined as injury sustained by a person. It's why the time.
Well, they also said that in bodily injuries, damages claimed by any person or organization for care, loss of services, or death, not just a human person.
So I agree with the quote up to where you stopped, Your Honor, but I would encourage you to read the rest of the sentence. Resulting at any time from, and what are the last three words?
From the bodily injury.
The bodily injury. That goes back to our point that these coverages are written and underwritten to respond to injuries to a particular person. And I would agree with you, a government, if there is proof of a tort to a particular person, a government could recover its costs, whether that be Medicare payments or whether it be other costs caused from indemnifying an employee. But you have to read the policy in context and the language as a whole. That's what this court said in Sauer versus Cruz when the Court of Appeals made the error of reading the word cargo out of context, and this said it. Court said you have to look more broadly at the context in which this policy language appears. These are coverages written for accidental personal injuries. That's why the phrase starts with legally obligated to pay his damages. That's why the term bodily injury is defined as bodily injury sustained by a person. What they're trying to do here is redefine bodily injury. It doesn't say bodily injury sustained by a person or group of persons public health hazard.
Counselor, so are you saying that the governmental entities should have tied individuals who were killed, who died by or suffered physical harm from opioid addictions, that the governmental entities would have had to name some of those people as as injured or as plaintiffs? I mean, are you saying the governmental entities just needed some identifiable individuals who suffered bodily injury as a result of the opioid addiction?
The government needed to prove that Masters harmed an identifiable person, is the way I would put it, Your Honor. And they could have done that by identifying particular individuals. They could have done that by saying, we pay costs on behalf of these particular individuals that Masters harmed.
But because no single individual was presented with bodily harm, although maybe there could be judicial notice of the harm that the opioid addiction caused to many people in these governmental entities' communities, because no individual person or persons were identified, coverage fails.
Because no individual persons were identified as allegedly being harmed by Masters, coverage fails. And, you know, Your Honor, I mean, it's not just, I don't think, as simple as saying there are people. Masters is one of several defendants that are named in this suit, right? And what you don't see in the 2,000 pages of complaints that are in the record is any allegation that Masters sold a product to any particular person who suffered from opioid addiction and thereby suffered bodily injury. That's not the claim.
Well, because that was going to be the next question. If they were identifiable people who suffered from opioid addictions and overdoses and they could identify, then, of course, you would say, well, you've got to identify that they overdosed on Master's product as opposed to anybody else's product.
You have to allege that in order to come within the personal injury coverage in the CGL policy. And again, this is not the only kind of coverage that's available, right? Masters is being defended under a director, an officer, and entity coverage. It's important to keep this coverage within the limits and the way it's written, because this coverage is designed to be broadly available, right? We're not just talking here about coverage that exists for a pharmaceutical distributor. We're talking about coverage that exists for small businesses, that exists for nonprofits like schools and churches, and it's written in a very particular way so it can provide that broad-based accidental personal injury coverage, which is why it talks about injury sustained by a person. It's why when you talk about these consequential or derivative damages, you're talking about it resulting at any time from the bodily injury. That is, the bodily injury that is identified in the complaint. Here, there is no injury to a particular person allegedly caused by Masters.
Is there in the pleading a reference to anybody with bodily injury? Any group?
All they reference is citizens. They're citizens.
Citizens.
Right.
Citizens with bodily injury, right? Citizens injured by this distribution.
Citizens injured by the opioid epidemic. They refer to citizens who have experienced addiction, but they do not bring claims on behalf of any of those citizens, and they do not seek derivative damages on behalf of any of those citizens. What they seek is the economic cost of the increased public services they provide.
They seek reimbursement for their expenditures to deal with the citizens who are injured as a result of their opioid addiction.
They seek reimbursement of the costs, but Your Honor, I mean, this goes into the difference between what the policy covers and what the policy doesn't cover. And I pointed in my brief to an example from the restatement of the law of restitution that goes into this. It's a section 24, comment H, and it talks about a union-sponsored health plan, all right? And it says if the union-sponsored health plan seeks to prove that against tobacco companies, that the tobacco comment harmed a particular participant, then they have a claim in restitution for that injury. If the union-sponsored health plan simply recovers the costs it paid, then they don't have that claim in restitution. And the point here is not whether or not these claims are ultimately recoverable under some theory. That's not before the court. And perhaps you can, for a public nuisance, recover all of these costs. My point is, those costs are not tied to an identifiable harm. And the policy is written to respond to a harm to a particular person, and it allows for recovery of consequential damages if those damages arise from the harm to a particular person.
So I want to stop you there. Your policy says damages because of bodily injury include damages claimed by any person or organization for care, loss of services, or death resulting from the bodily injury, correct?
Correct.
So where in there does this say it has to be a particular person when it's bodily injury including damages claimed by an organization for care? So when we go to Justice DeWine's example where the state pays Medicaid to provide for drug and alcohol treatment, well, for treatment services for individuals, or even for Narcan, I'm failing to see where there has to be an individual based on the terms of your policy.
At the end of the sentence, Your Honor, where it says resulting from the bodily injury. And the bodily injury, I mean, elsewhere in Master's brief, they say that the has a particularizing force, and I agree with it. It's particularizing the bodily injury. And bodily injury, again, is defined as injury sustained by a person. Everywhere throughout the policy, it is written in a way that's designed to respond to injuries to particular people. That's why that clause reads the way it reads all the way to the end. And as we said...
So you reject the H.D. Smith case out of West Virginia where the court equates a mother taking care of her child to the state taking care of those in need in terms of the health, safety, and welfare safety net that the state performs, correct? You reject that analogy.
I think the analogy only works if the state is asking for the care provided for the particular person. In the example you refer to, Your Honor, if the mother were to recover for the care she provided for the child, she would have to prove that the insurer tortiously injured the child. If the medical center who provides that care, free of cost, alleges and proves that the insurer tortiously injured the child, then absolutely those damages are covered. But that's not what this case is about. That's not what this claim is about. They are not trying.
Counsel, are you saying that at trial that it could not be shown that there were people, citizens, who suffered bodily injury?
I'm saying at trial, no one will try to prove that Masters tortiously caused bodily injury to any particular person, and that's what this policy is written to cover.
But the state can't pick and choose different people, and there might even be HIPAA concerns. Let's say you've got somebody in prison who's getting medical care. The state's paying for that. About 80% of the people in prison are there because of some kind of drug-related situation anyways. Maybe it started with opioids, maybe it didn't. I mean, how can you expect that your policy would apply that way when it talks about organization?
It applies that way because it talks about derivative obligations for care. And you know, really the purpose for the organization, and we did go into this, Your Honor, is because it is trying to clarify. Organizations are covered regardless of whether or not that clause exists. And we, you know, we talk about this. There's the Setterling case where you have an employer who pays on behalf of their harmed employee, and then they go against the insured and they recover. That's fine with us because in that case you were proving a tortious injury to the employee and the employer recovered on top of it. What that policy language you're talking about addresses is the timing issue, because when you are writing a policy to provide coverages for specific bodily injuries, there is a possibility that the person gets injured under one policy period, but the death occurs under the next policy period, or the care occurs under the next policy period, or the loss of services occurs sometime thereafter. And so that's why when you read that entire clause, it says resulting at any time from the bodily injury. We're talking about an injury to a specific person that happens at a particular moment of time, and the policy says these derivative damages that can be claimed because of that tortious injury to that one person will be covered even if they happen later. That's why that whole clause is written the way it's written.
So you didn't get a chance to get into the loss in progress, but the one question that I had in that area is, even though it may operate as an exclusion, you've argued that it sort of precedes the policy. Can you talk to me about the burden of proving that it's not excluded or it is excluded based on the loss in progress argument?
So we believe they have the burden, Your Honor, because it's a condition precedent to coverage. They have to show that they were unaware of any bodily injury before the inception of the policy in order to be covered.
And you're pointing out that their license revocation in 2009 put them on notice that essentially they were uninsurable on that issue, correct?
Basically, Your Honor, yeah. Our claim, the revocation occurred in 2015, but the revocation was based on conduct, including agreements with DEA and meetings with DEA, where all these problems were explained to their senior officers as of August 2009. And so we believe they were on notice as of then. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
All right, you've got 17 seconds. I'll give you a little more, though. Counsel? Mr. Rose?
Thank you and good morning. Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Paul Rose, counsel for Masters Pharmaceutical. Acuity's arguments are not currently supported by the law of any jurisdiction. Over the last 5 or 6 years, they've been rejected by every court across the country to consider them, sometimes rather harshly. There are three reasons for that. The arguments contradict the language of the policies. They fail to take into account rules of insurance policy construction, and they disregard the law regarding the breadth of the duty to defend. And that's very important. What we have here is a duty to defend case.
Let me ask you about that. I'm trying to understand kind of what the limiting principle to your theory is. So imagine that the state of California decided to sue Marathon Oil. Marathon had this policy language, and the suit was that fossil fuels had caused global warming. There'd been causing the state of California to have flooding, increased forest fires. The state has spent money to fight these fires and to deal with the flooding and other environmental disasters, and there had been increased skin cancers because of that, which cost the state money. Would that be covered?
Well, remember, this is a duty to defend case, and
would they have to defend? Because among the myriad of harms here, there are personal injuries, even though they're not directly seeking any recovery for that.
The operative language of the coverage grant is they have to defend if there are claims that Marathon is legally obligated to pay as damages because of property damage. That's the test. And in Ohio, in a duty to defend case, we look at two things to see whether the test is satisfied. We look at the language of the underlying complaints, and we look at the language of the policies. We know that from the Willoughby Hills case. And if there's potentially or arguably a claim pled that would fall within the indemnity coverage of the policy, the insurer must defend. The second thing we know about the duty to defend from the Sharonville case is if an insurer must defend any claim, it must defend every claim.
So they would have to defend this claim?
Well, Your Honor, we'd have to look at the pleadings to see whether the pleadings allege claims within the coverage grant of the policy. Based on your hypothetical, if the policy read as the Acuity policies do, yes, there would be a duty to defend.
The way I read the complaints, the underlying complaints was that the governments are suing for increased emergency services. Is that correct?
Well, in part, Your Honor, but there's much more than that. And I've read these complaints very carefully, and what they allege is bodily injury to specific identifiable persons, in respect of which, under their negligent counts and public nuisance counts, these insurers seek to be compensated for their past costs. And the complaints are very particular about that. For instance, sometimes they refer to the individual's damage in a narrative way. Morgan County, West Virginia, refers to a considerable number of the county's residents. But sometimes they're referred to as percentages. For instance, Pocahontas County, West Virginia, alleges it's entitled to compensation for its expenses incurred in regard to 34 drug overdoses per 100,000 population. But some of the complaints are very particularized in regard to numbers. For instance, Saginaw County, Michigan, seeks recovery for its expenses for 116 opioid-related hospitalizations in 2013. Mason County, Michigan seeks recovery of its expenses for 24 hospitalizations over a five-year period. The City of Lansing seeks recovery for its expenses for 243 doses of Narcan administered by its fire department. The City of Lanaulau, Michigan seeks recovery for its expenses related to six opioid-related deaths over 6 years. And on and on. The point is, these are very particularized allegations. Every one of these ambulances that went out to pick up someone picked up a specific person. Every dose of Narcan was administered to a specific person. Every hospital and treatment program admission was of a specific person. It is these specific costs as to these specific persons that these governmental entities pray for past cost reimbursement for in their complaints.
Counselor, does it matter whose drug? Does it matter whose drug was used in the particular overdoses?
Your Honor, that would certainly matter in the underlying cases. But this case concerns the duty to defend and whether Acuity must defend Masters in those underlying cases. That will be a matter to be resolved there, whether Masters will be determined to have any liability. We don't know, and we can't know. What we do know is that at the moment, our record is that Masters never harmed anyone. We know that from the affidavit of Richard Lauer, who testified that before these policies were issued, Acuity had no knowledge it had ever harmed anyone. Masters had no knowledge. Acuity has submitted no evidence that Masters has ever harmed anyone. The DEA has never made a determination that Masters has ever harmed anyone, and no court has ever made a determination that Masters has ever harmed anyone. That is our record. Now, those issues will be addressed in the underlying case, but they are not for our determination here today.
What about the loss in progress argument that your colleague made, saying that you had some kind of knowledge as early as 2009, the policy went into effect in 2010, both as to the substance of that allegation and the burden of proof in terms of how it operates as an exclusion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Let me try to address both parts of that. The operative policy language reads this way. There's coverage if prior to the policy period, no insured knew the bodily injury had occurred. It's a reference to a specific bodily injury. I've recited for you many instances where the pleadings allege specific bodily injuries to identifiable persons. It is knowledge of those bodily injuries.
But I guess I have a hard time understanding how you can read bodily injury so broadly in your first argument, and then it becomes so narrow when you look at the loss in progress provision.
Okay.
I mean, it seems if we're talking about if there's one definition of bodily injury, then it applies to both, right?
May I ask a point of order question? Shall I answer the second part of your question first, or shall I address your question, Your Honor?
Well, at some point, I'd like to hear the answer to both, but however you want to do it.
May I address your question and then get back to yours?
You
Thank
can.
You. There's no inconsistency, Your Honor. Bodily injury in regard to the coverage grant refers to the specific bodily injuries in respect of which these governments are seeking recovery. The 243 administered doses of Narcan, for instance, in the City of Lansing. Those are the bodily injuries invoked by the reference to bodily injury in the coverage grant. There are also the bodily injuries referred to in the prior known loss exclusion. They are the same bodily injuries. Masters did not know it had caused any bodily injury. There's no record that it has caused any bodily injury, but this is a duty to defend case, and critically, what we know without question is it is alleged to have caused bodily injury, which falls squarely within the coverage grant. Now, if I may get back to the second part of your question, In regard to the burden of proof, of course, is an issue at trial. The First District did include some dicta regarding burden of proof, but before the First District was a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment. On a motion for summary judgment, the burden is always on the movant. We know from this court's decision in Physicians Insurance versus Swanson, however, that language in a policy that has a limiting or exclusionary effect is to be construed as an exclusion, and the burden of proof on an exclusion is always on the insurer. Well, we've talked a bit about the duty to defend. I want to add a little bit more about the propositions of law. In regard to the first proposition, which is the economic loss argument, the language of the coverage grant is Acuity has to pay those sums that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of bodily injury. And the defense obligation is Acuity has the duty to defend the insured against any suit seeking those damages. Insurance policy language is not always clear, but this language is very clear. And the arguments of the parties are these. MPI contends that that language means what it says, and it asked this court to enforce that language as written. Acuity, however, asked the court to rewrite the language. In regard to the reference to damages, it asked the court to insert some limitations so that only direct damages would be recoverable or derivative damages recoverable, and economic damages would not be recoverable. That's their first argument. Secondly, they want to change the phrase because of bodily injury to read because of bodily injury by the underlying plaintiff. There are two problems with those arguments. First is the policies don't say that. They want the court to rewrite the policies and then construe the policies as rewritten to their benefit as the drafter. It would be difficult to violate more rules of insurance policy construction in a single ruling. But the second problem with their argument is the policies do provide coverage for bodily injury claims by organizations. Organizations cannot suffer bodily injury. All damage claims by organizations in respect of bodily injury are economic damages claims. If we accept Acuity's argument, we are writing out of the policy the express coverage for bodily injury claims by organizations.
Counsel, is it your contention that the complaints are asking for I'm over here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
With the masks, it's hard to tell who's speaking.
That's why I'm not wearing one.
I think.
I want to go back kind of to one of Justice DeWine's earlier questions. Is it your position that the complaints are asking for damages such as Medicaid and Medicare recoveries?
Your Honor, the complaints clearly pray for damages in respect of past bodily injury claims. They do that in regard to negligence and in regard to public nuisance. There are 22 different complaints at issue. They contain different allegations about what's encompassed. What's important for our analysis is that every allegation is tied to Master's alleged liability for damages for bodily injury.
But that's not my question. My question is it your contention that those complaints are asking for reimbursement for Medicare or Medicaid payments?
I don't recall a specific reference to Medicare or Medicaid. They're asking for reimbursement for the direct costs that these governments incurred ambulances and
ambulance runs,
exactly.
Things like that. That's the way I read it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In the little time I have left, I would like to address briefly, in a little more detail, the second proposition of law, which is the prior known injury argument. The complaints here do not allege that MPI, that Masters knew of any of these bodily injuries before the policies incepted. But they do seek damages for specific bodily injuries to specifically identifiable persons, as we talked about a little earlier. And if these claims aren't because of bodily injury, we have to ask ourselves, What are they because of? They're clearly because of bodily injury. MPI simply asked the court to enforce this language as written, because the reference in this exclusion is to the bodily injury. The word "the" is very clear and understandable. This court in Scurthy versus Withrow held "the" has a precise meaning and should be applied. Black's Law Dictionary defined "the" as something that particularizes the subject matter it precedes.
Counsel, the way I understand Mr. Sasse's statement about that is the bodily injury supports his position that you got to name somebody, that there has to be, you know, an identifiable person or group of people that have sustained bodily injury.
Yes, Your Honor, and those are two different concepts. Each of these persons is identifiable. If the governments are going to recover, they're going to have to establish in the underlying case who the people are that were picked up by these ambulances and what the charge was. But the city of Detroit alleges 4,000 opioid-related hospitalizations in the year 2013 alone. The city of Detroit didn't list 4,000 names. Under notice pleading, it's not required to. In effect, Acuity is asking this court to adopt a known risk exclusion. They're saying Masters was in the business of selling medications, some of which were opioid-based and were addictive. They should have known there was a risk. But there's no such thing in the law as a known risk exclusion. People buy liability insurance policies because they know of a risk. MPI simply asked this court to enforce this policy language as written, following its well-established rules of policy construction and applying its long-established rules regarding the duty to defend. And Masters asked that this court affirm the decision of the court below.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Sasse, you may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to explain briefly the tension between the two arguments you just heard and why they can't both be right. The complaints allege violations of the Controlled Substances Act that resulted in an illicit market for opioids. That market, the plaintiff's claim, Masters claims, gives rise to claims for bodily injury. And yet, on the other hand, the very same DEA proceedings that were cited in this complaint as the foundation for why Masters violated the Controlled Substances Act are somehow not notice of these exact same injuries. It just doesn't work. When you look at the Mansfield Plumbing case, Your Honor, when you look at the Katie case, when you look at the Mesa underwriting case, they all say, if you are aware of an injury of that type, then all subsequent injuries of the same type are excluded from coverage because of that prior knowledge. So if you're going to buy the theory that these claims are because of bodily injury, then you also need to follow that theory through to its logical conclusion and apply the loss in progress provision. Either way, the judgment of the First District should be reversed and the trial court's declaratory judgment for Acuity should be reinstated. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Gentlemen, we'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marsha, will we call a recess?
All right.